Good evening, Robert. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you very much. It's very kind that you have time to have this small chat with me.
Now, you've recently published a rather interesting finding about sound in the atmosphere of the sun.
Yeah, that's correct. We had a press release a couple of weeks ago. What we have found is an evidence for acoustic waves in the atmosphere of the sun. The sun is a three-dimensional, we can imagine the sun as a three-dimensional elastic gas ball, and as such it can oscillate. If we kick a ball or if we kick an elastic body, then it can oscillate. However, there is one other aspect what maybe an elastic gas ball wouldn't have and the sun will have, and that is the magnetic field. The sun is full with magnetic field, which is generated somewhere in the internal part below the surface of the sun, what we cannot see, and then this magnetic field from time to time pops through the surface and forms a loop structure. And what happens, there are at least two possible mechanisms which can plug these giant magnetic loops. By the way, the size of the loops, just to give an idea about what sort of loops we are talking about, the length of these loops could be of the order of 100,000 kilometers. So they are really massive loops, sometimes even 400,000 kilometers. Now, what happens very often in the solar atmosphere, there are explosions. We call them flares, or if they are smaller, we call them microflares, or if they are even smaller, we may call them nanoflares. Now, if a flare explodes somewhere in the atmosphere of the sun, it can excite blast waves, shock waves, and as the shock waves propagate, they can hit these myriads of magnetic loops, and then the loop starts to oscillate. This is one mechanism how loops can oscillate. The second mechanism is that explosions happen inside of these magnetic loops, somewhere close to the solar surface, what we call, we call these explosions nanoflares. And if the conditions are right, then acoustic waves will propagate along the loop and will be bounced back from the other end of the loop. And as I said, if the conditions are right, then they can form a so-called standing wave, the same type of waves what you would have if you go to the church and listen to an organ pipe. So in a sense, the sun has the magnetic organ pipes, and if you excite these organ pipes properly, then can produce acoustic waves. Of course, the acoustic waves are on a much lower frequency. It is not directly visible for the human ear because the frequency is of the order of a few millihertz. Now, the human ear is sensitive between, I would say, 5 hertz up to maybe 20,000 or 16,000 hertz. So you wouldn't be able to hear this music directly or noise directly. What we have done, we have actually accelerated these acoustic oscillations to be audible for the human ear, and that's what you can find on my website and download it, and then you will hear this so-called heavenly music. This is how one of the journalists labeled our work.
Now, in what way is this different from the sounds that have been done before from the from inside the sun?
Yes, in a sense, they are physically they are the same phenomenon. They are acoustic waves in an acoustic resonator. Like I could even say that these waves are very similar to acoustic waves in a guitar or in a violin. So physically, they are the same waves. The difference is that about 10 years ago, I don't know exactly when, there was a press release by the Stanford group about the internal waves. These waves are bounced back in the internal part of the sun. Meanwhile, our waves, what we have seen, acoustic waves, are actually bounced back in the atmosphere of the sun. Now, the reason why we do this research, or the reason why this is interesting, is because we would like to understand that how these loops are formed and how these loops maintain their very high temperature. You should know that, or maybe the people who listen to this radio show, they know a little bit about the sun or about stars, that as you go away from the surface of the sun or the surface of the stars, actually the temperature starts to rise. And this is very odd because, you know, usually if you are close to a radiator, you feel hot. If you go away from a radiator, from the source, then you would expect that temperature temperature goes down. Now, in the solar atmosphere, something opposite happens. You go away from the energy reservoir, from the internal part of the sun. In the atmosphere, if you go away from the surface of the sun, the temperature starts to rise. And the surface of the sun has temperature about 6,000 Kelvin. Meanwhile, if you go a little bit away from the surface, I would say 2,000 kilometer, 2,500 kilometer, then this is little in astronomical terms. Of course, 2,500 kilometer is a lot, but if you go away a little bit from the surface of the sun, the temperature rises up to a few million Kelvin. And the interesting scientific question here is that how these magnetic loops with this extremely high temperature can be stable and can be there sometimes for weeks or hours or weeks or even months. And we would like to understand how plasma is the fourth state of material. You know, we have solid, we have liquid, and we have gas, and the fourth state is the so-called plasma state. And the question is that how plasma can be confined at such a high temperature for such a long time. If we would understand this question, then probably we could, you know, if we could, we could learn from nature how nature produces this very high temperature trapped plasma. Maybe we could use this, and we it could help us to design our tokamaks and our future generation energy production devices.
That's nuclear fusion to join hydrogen and helium here on Earth, so we can get virtually unlimited power.
Yes, exactly. That is our major problem. That we need, you know, natural energy resources are finite, so we need to find a clean energy source which doesn't produce pollution. Fusion, in principle, would be the ideal energy source. If I remember correctly, I think from 2.5 gram lithium and 100 liter tap water, if fusion would work, these two ingredients would be enough to produce energy for an entire generation of a Western European or an Australian household, because now we are in Australia. So we have plenty of water, we have plenty of lithium, so if we would know how fusion works, then I think we would have a major leap in saving our environment and producing energy, enough energy for our children and our grandchildren.
Now, going back to these sounds from the sun, everyone knows, of course, that sound can't travel through space. So you're not listening to the sounds directly. How is it done?
Yes, we have satellites. We have used actually the so-called TRACE satellite. This is an American satellite built by Lockheed Martin and in collaboration with NASA. The satellite was launched in, if I remember, 1995 or 1996, and we use there are various cameras on the satellite, on this TRACE satellite, and we use these cameras to make observations in the solar atmosphere. We analyze these observations, and we deduce from intensity and Doppler maps, we deduce the necessary scientific information to reconstruct what could happen in the solar atmosphere.
So basically, you're looking at the changing colour of the sun, sort of, and then transmitting that by radio back to Earth, and then computerizing it back into sound.
I wouldn't say colour. I would maybe say, although in a sense you are right, because we use specific wavelengths, so you can interpret it as colour. Usually, these wavelengths are not in the visible spectrum; they are in the ultraviolet domain. Yes, we do observations in the ultraviolet domain. And intensity observations, and when we look at periodicities in the intensity oscillations, and that's how we then deduce the physical phenomena, what generate these changes in the EUV spectrum.
Now, SOHO, as you've mentioned, has been operating now for 10 years, with a few breaks, but still going strong. How long do you expect it will continue?
I think funding is now secured for another couple of years. I hope that it will work as long as it's possible. Usually these satellites are designed for just a couple of years, but very often we find that there is no degradation in the performance, and if there is enough support from NASA or European Space Agency or some other space agency, then we do not turn off these satellites until maybe a better satellite with a higher resolution spatial and temporal resolution is built. I think that SOHO will be around for another 5-10 years. That's my expectation. Although a new satellite was launched very recently last year, the so-called Hinode satellite is a Japanese satellite led by the Japanese space agency JAXA, and United Kingdom, where I come from, we also contributed to that. And one of the instruments on board Hinode is actually has a UK principal investigator. And then there will be new satellites coming. Next year we are going to launch another satellite, the so-called SDO, Solar Dynamic Observatory satellite. And then in the pipeline there are a few more which hopefully will come through. And ESA, European Space Agency, and NASA will support them. And hopefully we will have a continuous coverage of solar observations for the next 20, 30 years.
So if we're not... SOHO were to fail... because it is getting quite old, we'd not be completely cut off from that stream of data from the sun.
No. At the moment, we have already Hinode, and then, as I said, SDO will come next year, and hopefully some other satellites will come as well. There are other satellites in other countries also plan missions. Some of them are in infancy stage, some of them are maybe better developed, but I think that there will be now a continuous coverage of solar observations. You see, the key point here is that this success was so enormous due to SOHO and TRACE that so much physics was learned, and then this physics was turned into technology for societal benefit. It's not just taxpayer money spent on some scientist dream, but there is real benefit of this. As I said, one of the benefits could be the fusion realization of the fusion device with a high efficiency, not just to make a fusion, but also there is a very serious efficiency. So we put little energy in it, and we will gain a huge amount of energy. That's one of the goals. Beside, of course, there is the goal, the scientific acquiring and the scientifically to understand the environment where we live. If we are serious about traveling to the Mars, and maybe if we are serious about building some bases on the Moon, then we have to understand very well what's going on the Sun, because all these high energy explosions actually affect seriously the Earth's magnetic field, and if we make interplanetary trips probably in the next 50-100 years, then we have to protect ourselves against this radiation. So we have to be able to predict when and with what amount this solar radiation comes out, and we have to shield ourselves, otherwise we will not survive.
After all, the Sun is the nearest operating nuclear fusion reactor.
Properly operating, yes, that's correct. And we have to understand this. And but there are other factors. The nuclear fusion is one aspect. The second aspect is the space exploration, the human space exploration. And if we are serious about that, then we really have to predict carefully when flares occur and this high energy radiation. When the high energy radiation, we have to predict when flares occur in order to be able to shield ourselves. Otherwise, we will not survive. A space tourist cannot survive that. You will develop very quickly cancer and you will die from the radiation.
Now, Robert, you're from the University of Sheffield. What's the main area of work of your group there?
It's a standard British university. We are among the elite universities. I would say I work at the Department of Applied Mathematics, and my group is in the Department of Applied Mathematics. I think we are four or five now here from that group. Probably we are the largest in terms of numbers at this conference from the same place. we all do various aspects of solar physics, either the interior or the atmosphere of the sun. And the organizer, Professor Kelly from Monash University, is a colleague of mine, and once he visited us about 2 years ago, and then we discussed why not to have a meeting in Australia. So this is how this meeting actually started. And then the European Space Agency and some other agencies also gave us some financial support, and that's how we ended up, and we are about 50 or 60 people working on solar physics, and mainly on the aspect of how the interior of the sun is coupled into the atmosphere, which is, I think, a fairly new field of solar physics.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight on this space show, Robert.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time, and I enjoyed it.
And we'll listen again now to those sounds from the atmosphere of the sun.